This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Over the past year or so, governments around the Middle East have been rocked by political protest. To much of the world, it seemed that people who had long suffered in silence had suddenly decided that they would take no more, rising up to claim their freedom. In fact, our guest for this hour, Marwan Bishara, says that these events were the result of a long social and political struggle. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about the history behind the Arab Spring, a history that our guest says the West largely ignored. We'll also try to look ahead and talk about what is likely to happen now in places like Egypt and Tunisia, other places over the next couple of years. Our guest, Marwan Bishara, is senior political analyst at Al Jazeera English. He is the editor and host of its flagship show, Empire. He was previously lecturer of international relations at the American University of Paris. His writing has appeared in many places: New York Times, International Herald Tribune, Washington Post, Newsweek, Guardian, Le Monde, others. And he is the author of a recently published book. The title of the book is The Invisible Arab: The Promise and Peril of the Arab Revolution. Nation Books is the publisher. Questions as we talk are welcome. As always, we just ask people to try to be brief so we can get as many people in as possible, keep moving along, but questions are welcome. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We also have email. You can send your question, comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, questions, comments are welcome. And Mr. Bishara, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to talk about the idea that you're getting at, I think, with the title. In part, I think the idea is that the people, you're arguing that, the forces that came to bring this thing that we call the Arab Spring, the people that were involved in this, they were there, but that for many observers in the West, people who might indeed count themselves as experts or at least interested in the politics of the Middle East, they just didn't see it.
They didn't see it, or at times they didn't want to see it, or they didn't report it, or they didn't analyze it enough. Mm. Certainly they have been in various Middle East departments and certain specialized publications in the United States, some very smart people who had keen eye on to what goes on in the region. But generally speaking, American academia and American mainstream media did not pay attention to the people on the ground, and especially the activist citizens of the Arab world, because they were limited in their focus, because they were controlled, if you will, in their approach by the agenda of the day, and that have changed a bit, but certainly it has been more or less energy security, national security, in that case terrorism, mm, or Israel security. And because of that, they never really either bothered or were interested, or their publications or their platforms did not give enough time for them here in this country to explore the movements, the forces, and the people acting on the ground every day, every week, for several decades now against dictatorships.
Mm. I think, though, you make also an interesting argument that perhaps because governments in the region had been so ruthless in cracking down against dissidents, opponents, that perhaps in the region and in some of these countries, that the kinds of political activists would have been invisible to their countrymen.
Precisely. Not only were those Arabs invisible to the rest of the world, mm-hmm, they also were invisible to the rest of their societies, because state-controlled medias and state-controlled academias in the Arab world made sure that opposing voices do not make it on television or in press, or do not stay in universities. So much so that not only were opposing or intelligent or humane Arab voices were kept away from the mainstream public opinion, if you will, in the Arab world, but also they were imprisoned, tortured, sent to exile, and certainly intimidated in such ways whereby their voices would not be heard by the majority. Of course, they did find ways and means in which they would connect, especially with the popularization of technology and the capacity of them to connect with more people. But generally speaking, yes, repressive dictators made sure that a lot of those democratic free voices would not reach to the rest of the people.
Hmm. Just for a second, since you raised it, and maybe this is something we could talk about some more later, but I guess now it's in my mind. So much was made of the role of social media in what we have seen. And at the same time, I think some people have said, well, yes, you can't say that that's not important, but that maybe the important, it has been overstated. What's your thought?
I think social media, new media in general, is important. But it is important as many other factors are also important. The problem with the projection of social media as the magic with which revolutions or uprisings have taken place is simply it comes out of ignorance, not maturity, not knowledge. And what do I mean by that? I think social media, as I said, played an important role. But those who could not see what are the other forces, those who never detected, who never observed, who never studied the Arab world, projected the technoculture that is that certainly omnipresent in the West on the Arab revolutions and on the Arab societies in such ways where as soon as reporters were parachuted on Tahrir Square, on November 7 Square, and so on and so forth, and they saw young people acting the way they did, they picked on that one thing they are familiar with, which is new media. Of course, new media was present in those demonstrations, on the organizing of those demonstrations. But in the way in which projecting social media as the leader of the Arab uprising, that I think was the problem in the way they approached it, and that made social media a cliche, not a true instrument that, in fact, helped groom an entire new generation. Just like any advance in technology since many centuries have, you know, since the industrialization age, onto the print press and through to the radio, television, cassettes and DVDs, and onto the new media, all of those, of course, helped people organize. Because, you know, any sociologist will tell you, well, not any, but I mean, a keen sociologist will tell you, we fight wars, we mount revolutions the way we do business. And these were the instruments available to the people in the Arab world, and they used them well.
Our guest in this part of Focus this first hour, Marwan Bishara. He is senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English. He is the author of the new book, The Invisible Arab, The Promise and Peril of the Arab Revolution. Nation Books is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Part of the book is an exploration of history of the Arab world after colonialism and asking some questions about how it is that, well, one might say that the governments were different in maybe some significant ways, that there was certainly something that they all shared in common, and that was the lack of fondness for democracy. Why is it that, and I know this is something that's complicated, one could write, I'm sure, a very big book just about this, but what do you think are the important things that happened at that point, at the point of independence, that got these countries locked into the political systems that they had?
Generally speaking, in Western media and academic circles, and especially over the last 10 years, there was a revisionist history of sort, David, a history that tried to look at, and here I'm quoting, what went wrong, unquote, in the Arab world by looking at religious factors, looking at cultural factors, as if the Arabs were genetically backward, as if their religion was centered against freedom and humane progress and so on and so forth. And what I try to do here is really show why None of that is true. That it is not a question of Islam, and certainly not a question of any intrinsic backwardness, cultural backwardness with the Arabs. That over the last 50, 60 years since the end of colonialism, it was power. It was the use, misuse, and abuse of power in the Arab world through dictatorships that were commonplace in every single Arab country. Arabs were governed by dictators. Those dictators were quite repressive. They sort of gained legitimacy from some of them, from their struggle against colonialism, took on power and simply held onto power in undemocratic ways, spread their powers through tribal, through security apparatuses and other means of state in such a way whereby they interfered in the private life, in the private sector in every possible way, really allowing them to dominate people. It differs, of course, from one country to the other. In some countries it was, let's call it repression light, and in other countries it was completely totalitarian and repressive to the utmost against people. But be that as it may, it was the misuse and abuse of politics in the Arab region that led to what has gone wrong, if you will, among the Arab countries. Mm.
And how much of that has to do with the West and its interest in maintaining stability in the region, maintaining access to oil? And we overlay on all of that, I suppose, the struggle for influence everywhere in the world between the United States and the Soviet Union that existed during the Cold War.
This is of course very important. The Cold War has deepened the repression in the Arab world because Moscow and Washington, and to a different extent, you know, Berlin and London, if you're East Berlin and London, sponsored dictators in the Arab world and supported them as clients of superpowers, and hence whatever those clients wanted, or those clients got. Whether it is training their infamous security forces or arming their militaries or even supporting and subsidizing their dictatorships. If you would have expected that from Moscow, out of a totalitarian system that had interest in other totalitarian systems in, say, Libya, Iraq, Syria, or what have you, here in Washington, the question was a bit different. The rhetoric was over the years that of democracy, freedom, and progress, and so on and so forth. But in reality, the policies were forging alliances with dictators, autocrats, and authoritarian regimes that repressed their people. So the credibility gap between how Washington acted and what Washington said was so big that people in the region lost faith in any good thing coming out of Washington in real terms, that Washington simply talks the talks but doesn't walk the walk, if you will.
Mm-hmm. I think you're making the argument in the book that the people who are responsible for the wave of change that we've seen over the last year or so, the miracle generation, the young people, really in many ways are standing on the shoulders of those who came before them. And that's something that, again, I think it's a history that you say that we don't know and that we should, and that if you were perhaps more familiar with that, you certainly wouldn't think that the Arab Spring just came out of nowhere. So having said all that, what constituted the opposition in those previous generations, and was there particularly a significant opposition that was secular?
Yes, indeed. Even the ruling elites and ruling parties and ruling dictatorships had among them those who opposed the degree to which repression was going on, and they were punished for it. So, you know, a good number, for example, of Ba'ath Party, the ruling Ba'ath parties in Iraq would see themselves tortured or imprisoned to death. Some of them disappeared in prisons in solitary confinement for decades because they dared oppose the dictators or because they dared speak in favor of more opening in the system. So even from within some of those secular ruling parties and elites, we found that many, many had to pay heavy price for opposing dictatorships. But on a lower level, you could say that from the middle classes and lower middle classes, from the civil society and the political opposition parties everywhere from Algeria to Iraq, thousands, you could say indeed millions of people suffered because of their stance against dictatorship. A lot of them were purged in the most ugly and the most horrific of ways, simply like the Assad regime or the Saddam regime or the Gaddafi regime imprisoned thousands upon thousands of people. You know, one of the things I discovered researching for the book, that the prison novel is, in fact, more widespread in the Arab world than it is in most others. And I thought Latin America would have been the one, but indeed, the prison novel, meaning the novels inspired by an experience in prison, was most common in the Arab world because most vocal intellectuals in the Arab world ended up being imprisoned, if not killed or exiled. Mm. And one such person that a good friend of mine, David, that I tell of his story, an Egyptian intellectual and human rights activist who built the Human Rights Center in Cairo, and who wrote a book about torture, was after it imprisoned and tortured in prison and died soon after that. And it was that same Egyptian intellectual, Mohammed Said Said, who also wrote a book back in 1997, before we had anything called Facebook, Twitter, Google, and so on and so forth. Back in 1997, he wrote a book about technology and the struggle for democracy and human rights in the Arab world. So you can imagine those people who were visionaries, who were activists, and who were simply tortured and died in the cause of freedom. None of their stories, and they are, as I said, in the thousands upon thousands, and millions of them suffered. And yet, we haven't heard their stories. We don't know their names. All what we know nowadays, and here, of course, I don't say it in any bitter or wrong way, because I know, for example, the likes of Wael Ghanem is an activist who also spent a few days in Egyptian jails, who's a blogger and who struggled in favor of his the people of his country. But today in America, we know the Google executive. The Google executive is more known, I mean, as an expression, as a cliche, than thousands upon thousands of invisible Arabs who did far more than the new blogger around the block, because a title could be attached to his name, and that is a Google executive, while the lawyers, the doctors, the professors, the intellectuals, the writers, the novelists who paid their life over decades of resistance to dictatorships are invisible. Mm. To the outside world.
Well, having said that there was this long, as you say, this long social political struggle that had gone on in for decades and perhaps across a generation or maybe more, leading up to what happened now in first in Tunisia and then in Egypt and a lot of other places. Having your argument that if you knew that you might not have been surprised that the Arab Spring happened, I think that you have said that still there the way that it happened, the way that it came about, there were still some things here that even for somebody who was a seasoned observer of the politics of the region might have said that they were surprised. Were there some things here in the way that these events unfolded that even you would say, yes, I was surprised?
Of course. That's why it's called a revolution. You know, the gurus, the inspirational voices of the French revolutions never expected it to happen, nor did those of the American revolutions, because if you remember, I'm sure a lot of your listeners know all too well, the American Revolution started by people asking for reform in laws in this country. And the same thing in the French Revolution started with loyalists, in fact, royalists, I should say. Asking for change, asking for reform. No one expected the Russian Revolution to happen the way it did, or the Chinese, or the Iranian, for that matter. So this is the idea of a revolution, is that the sudden break with the past, of course, I think there is absolutely no point of trying then to look retroactively and see what we've missed, how we missed. There's something about all the ducks lining up at one point, and something happens that I think, it's not exactly magical, but there is no point of torturing ourselves, figuring out why we didn't figure it out. Mm-hmm. What's important to underline is that every revolution is preceded with an evolution, and that evolution is historic, it is social, it is political, and it goes over many, many years leading up to a revolution. How certain events lead up to a revolution, that, of course, is more subjective to specific circumstances that are not necessarily part of, the academic domain or the media domain of trying to predict that revolutions will take place.
We have a caller, and we'd welcome others, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest for this hour focus is Marwan Bishara. He is senior political analyst with Al Jazeera English. He is editor, host of their flagship show, Empire, and is the author of a new book, Looking at the Arab Spring. The Invisible Arab is the title of the book. We'll go for a tour to our first caller, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I had two things I wanted you to address. I guess I'll start with the first thing about one of the seminal movements in the Egypt Arab Spring came out of a group that took their name from a date of a previous labor struggle. The Egyptian textile workers, mostly women, I think almost all women, had a strike, and the date of their strike became the name of the one of the organizing groups. Obviously, there are many different threads in this, but I think the fact that this dimension, I just don't think it gets discussed enough, and I'm not sure whether you treat it much in your book or whether you can say something extemporaneously about it. But it seems to me that that's quite an interesting dimension. Now, the other thing, and I'll get it out now, I guess, is pretty complicated, but when one thinks about the Arab world, one thinks about, in a lot of places in the West or the North, one thinks about petrochemicals and oil. And I think there's a dimension of this that ought to be treated. The reason we've had the deals with the Saudis, princes and kings, for so long, and we overlook their excesses, is because of petrochemicals. But there's a dimension in Egypt that I think I'm just surprised doesn't get treated, which is this gas pipeline. Apparently, there's an old truism about Arab states. Some of them have water, some of them have oil. Only a few have both, and one of them, that one was Iraq. And Egypt is always said to have the water and not the oil, but they do have gas, and they have a gas pipeline that supplies Arab states, but it also supplies Israel. And apparently Israel gets about 40% of its natural gas from this pipeline, and it's priced artificially low at 40% of the world market price for natural gas. So the reason I bring it up, it was a cause célèbre in the street at Tahrir Square. I remember hearing about it, and the dimension that I heard about it, and having not really known about it elsewhere, was because of the corruption involved. Gamal Mubarak apparently was Mr. 5% on that deal. A lot of Egyptians are still very angry about the whole premise of the deal. Apparently, on February 4th, there was another clandestine attack on it and blew it up again, which has been happening multiple times to not much. So I'm frustrated that that isn't discussed. It is a dimension of the uprising. Egyptian uprising is often seen as being internal and driven by internal forces, and maybe it won't affect the geopolitics, but something like that, and the whole that whole dimension seems to belie that idea that anything in the Arab world can be, and any particular state in the Arab world can be isolated from these kind of greater deals and geopolitical, and of which oil and petrochemicals is the great prize.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's.
I'll listen on.
All right.
For a bit.
That's go ahead, Mr. Bishara.
Well, David, certainly you have quite a well-informed listeners, and I certainly agree with what I heard. And I do address it in a book at length. Indeed, one of my subtitles is "Where Are the Men?" Because back in that April 6th date, and that's what the movement's called, April 6th, the labor strikes against the management in this, of course, you know, sort of a new liberal way that led to deep corruption in the textile industry in Egypt because of the way it was managed and how it was outsourced, by corporations outside Egypt, led the labor, especially women, in the textile business, to revolt, for better pay and better working circumstances and so on. Now, the April 6th movement that helped with this very particular strike that really paralyzed the national textile industry, it came from the ranks of another movement called Kifaya, which asked for that there'll be no succession for President Mubarak in Egypt. And here, if you allow me to connect both points made by your listener, indeed, the April 6th movement that worked along with youth and labor movements, and before that, the political movements of Kifaya, which means enough of dictatorship, and we didn't want the son to follow after the father, that came from the ranks of yet another movement, and that was called the Popular Committees. And the Popular Committees was not indeed organized around domestic factors or causes. The Popular Committees were originally those in solidarity with Palestinians for the Palestinian Intifada, and later on in solidarity with the people of Iraq after the American invasion of Iraq in 2003. And the Popular Committees that organized on sort of pan-Arab questions and against the Israeli and the American occupations of Palestine and Iraq did lead to a serious political movement in the country that then started addressing domestic, economic, and social issues. And in the ways, and I tell that story again, that this happened is when the April 6th youth started using the question of the selling gas to Israel as a good way to connect domestic with foreign, and accuse the government of corrupt deal with Israel in the way they sold gas. And the slogan at the time was, and that was brilliant, really. I mean, how can you make something so geopolitically and regionally as well as domestically familiar to an average Egyptian? And it was by saying, you don't have electricity, you can't even afford electricity, electricity gets cut every day or two in your own neighborhood, but Israelis can get cheap gas, our own gas, because you have corrupt leaders. The way in which that message was connected allowed the activists to expand their movement, and many, many more Egyptians would join in the movement because of the simplicity of its slogans and its programs, but yet because of the complexity in which it could connect such important domestic and foreign issues that affect the day-to-day life in Egypt.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. We'll talk some more with our guest Marwan Bashar from Al Jazeera, talking about his book, The Invisible Arab, looking at the promise and peril of the Arab Revolution. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
Illinois public media stations celebrate 90 years of public service broadcasting. To kick off a year of memories and celebrations, NPR congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook will visit the WILL studios. Join Andrea Seabrook and the WILL news team for a wine and cheese reception on Wednesday, April 11. Tickets are $25 a person. Reservations can be made by calling 217-333-7300.
Support comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Ecstatic and Exotic, with harpist Bridget Kabi in Rodrigo's Concierto, Serenata, and Scheherazade, with guest conductor Ray Hotoda, February 24th at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts and the 25th at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield. Details at ilsymphony.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we'll have another in a series of conversations that we're having with candidates who'll be competing in the March primary here in Illinois. The guest in the second hour is Shane Cultra. He's a senator, now a senator in the Illinois State Senate, and he is running for his party's spot on the ballot in the new 53rd district of the Illinois State Senate. So we'll certainly talk about budget matters, a big challenge here for the state of Illinois. And I do also want to mention that tomorrow, Illinois Governor Pat Quinn will be giving his budget message. So we'll have some better idea what he's thinking of in terms of spending and where spending needs to be cut. And then also on the program Thursday, we'll get some reaction to what the governor has to say in our 11 o'clock hour as we welcome here to the studio two guests who have been, both of them have been here on the program before. Fred Gertz, he is an economist, and also Bob Rich, he is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the U of I, and also Fred has an affiliation with the Institute, and we'll talk a little bit about the Illinois state budget. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon. You can get the schedule by going to the website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter, Will Public Media, and you can also find us on Facebook. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Marwan Bishara. He's a senior political analyst with Al Jazeera English, editor, host of their program Empire, author of the new book The Invisible Arab, about the events of the Arab Spring. It's published by Nation Books. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will hyphen talk at illinois.edu. Just before I go into another caller, I think it's interesting that I think a lot of the coverage of these events has focused on the role of young people, people who are often well-educated and have aspirations to have a style of life that's much more compatible with their peers around the world, and felt stymied in that. I think what's interesting about your comments to the last caller would suggest that maybe one of the things that happened, at least in Egypt, I don't know if it happened elsewhere, but you had perhaps different groups of people with different political agendas and perhaps also coming out of different class backgrounds, finding some common ground around which they could organize.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, I think the two are not mutually exclusive. I think it's just, I think the idea of youth and social media was spoken about in such cliches that it was suddenly, you know, made into something sacred or something that could not be explained, and certainly something that is not part and parcel of an evolution in a society, and I certainly disagree with that reading. I think youth are part and parcel of their societies, and they've inherited a very important culture of resistance from their peers and from their elders, and I think they built on that using, you know, whatever, as I said, tools available to them. So I think there's a continuity in the struggle for freedom and democracy in the Arab world, and it was important that the youth were the catalyst. That's what's most important about their role, is that their energy, their organizing, the freshness of their approach, the simplicity of their slogans, the post-ideological, if you will, approach to their struggle, made it possible then for all sorts of other organizations, political parties, as well as ideological, religious, secular, leftist, liberal groups to join in, all as Egyptians, as Tunisians, as Arabs, indeed, joining the youth with one simple goal in mind, that is to undo a dictatorship. And generally speaking, their slogans were also quite clear to every person, and that is bread or jobs, and it was freedom and social justice. You know, no one could disagree about that. And in a way, the way various sectors of society joined the revolution. And by the way, it might be interesting for your viewer, for your listeners, probably to look at that one chapter in the book that I address at length, which is when the soccer, you know, the foot, as it was, we call it in that region, the football, when the soccer supporters joined the revolution, That's when it was possible to really confront the infamous security forces, because those soccer supporters were, of course, tough guys. They became suddenly politicized, and they were able to defend the revolutions against the infamous repression of the security forces in the squares and the streets of the Arab world, and in many ways it helped bring about the change that we saw in Egypt and other places.
All right. Well, let's talk with another caller in Belgium here, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning to you all. In the last couple of comments, your guest has touched on my question. The elite in the governments in the Arab world seem to control large portions of the economic systems in these areas, and because of their demands on how much they get returns on it, they've forced unemployment very, very high. It seems that unemployment should have some effect in this whole thing. Would you like to explain why these idle hands have gotten into these situations?
Yes, I think it's, your comment is especially important if we look at it in the context of the last 10, 20 years. Because until 10, 20 years ago, even the most repressive of governments did provide for some form of welfare state of some kind. A lot of them ran on a rentier-like system whereby there was a sort of, the papa state, the kind of the parent-like state, whereby repression came with some form of welfare to the people. Of course, it was very limited, it wasn't serious, but there was some sort of an idea that that leaders would at least provide something to the people. That we saw decline over the last 10, 20 years, and with the mounting of the so-called Washington Consensus and its spread into the Arab world, suddenly we have this twinning of politically repressive with economically corrupt regimes. And the economically corrupt, and by the way, and I kind of go on and on explaining that a bit in the book, it was quite phenomenal how the elders, sort of the senior dictators, the Gaddafis, the Assads, the Mubarak of the world, would maintain a Beijing-like consensus, which is sort of repressive, top-down, political system, totalitarian system, while their sons would take on a more economically liberal, hence in their dictionary, corrupt, despotic system, treated very well by Western corporations, by world corporations, by multinational corporations from all over the place, because in the way they opened their economies to multinational corporations, and creating that dual system whereby the sons would oversee a neoliberalized corrupt economy leading to terrible unemployment and terrible social injustice, while at the same time their parents, the elder dictators, overseeing a repressive system, a political system through repressive security and military systems. And I think that duality created among the young generation of the last 10 years or more a certain bitterness, because they were, yes, college educated, but at the same time they were unemployed. They couldn't provide for their families. The gap between the rich and poor really increased, but they also became ever more educated about social justice and so on and so forth through satellite and new media, and hence created this new explosive combination, if you will, of social political consciousness coupled with terrible economic and political repression leading to what we have today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk about what you think might happen in the years ahead. And it seems that you can look at two situations. We have places, for example, places like Tunisia and Egypt, where change was accomplished without violence, although there are places where people say they're just at the beginning. It is definitely not a finished, the revolution is not finished. And then we have other places where there was a great deal of violence, where in effect we had civil war, a place like Libya. And then there's the case of Syria, where some people are concerned that might eventually come to civil war. Taking the first kind of case first, what do you think is, how do you think things are likely to develop in places like Tunisia and Egypt?
You know, David, if you allow me just sort of to share with your listeners a story I have shared with a local university here, after a 15-hour trip from overseas, and I was given that you know, that form where you assess the flight, and for some reason I have that face. I'm always given those forms to assess how the flight went and so on and so forth. And you know, on that questionnaire, there's always some very specific things you need to answer, and clearly your point of departure, your point of arrival, how many stops, how was the security, how was the convenience. You know, what were you looking for, and how were your expectations met, and so on and so forth. And those you can easily fill when it comes to a flight from point A to point B. I'm just afraid that for many, the perception about revolutions is very similar to that of a flight. That it's clear where you're coming from, and it's clear where you're going to, and it's clear how you assess anything in between. I'm afraid revolutions, and as I was speaking earlier, evolutions to the revolutions and evolutions post-revolutions could not be as easily assessed. And sometimes they're not even assessed in a lifetime, let alone in a week, in a month, in a day. And that's why this book is by no means a way in which, you know, I'm trying to assess those revolutions. I think a revolution is a break with the past. But what transpires after it is really a question that will be subjective to people's will and to the counter-revolutionary movements in the Arab world. So as you stated very well, I mean, in Libya, for example, we saw this getting complicated because there was a will of the people, but also there was quite a staunch, stubborn dictatorship that is willing to go all the way, sort of the so-called, you know, me or the flood type logic, whereby dictators, as we see also today in Syria, trying to bring down the country with them and threatening people simply with saying, if we cannot govern, then we will make sure that there is nothing to be governed, meaning that there will be no country. I think in Tunisia and Egypt, we saw something a bit different because the national armies in those two countries simply would not have it that way. And in the midst of the revolution, they turned against the dictator in a semi-coup d'etat of sort, and that's why those generals remain, in, you know, where they are, and in many ways they are now in a bit of a heat, if you will, with the rest of the revolution, which complicates the process forward. So in countries like Libya and Syria, it creates major violence, major breakdown in the system and in the country, and so on and so forth. In other places like Tunisia and Egypt, it creates a more complex transitional process that probably will take a long time. But in either case, and also in the case of Yemen, and in the case of Bahrain, and also even in the case of Morocco, whereby the king has allowed in for a new constitution and for new elections and allowing the opposition, even the Islamist opposition, to take power, really complicates the picture of the Arab revolution. So in a way, you could say, David, that there is specificity to each and every country, but there is a general break with the past in the Arab world. And for me, this is the revolution. It's a revolution of consciousness. So regardless of the specific changes and events that we will see or that we saw over the last year, we will see over the next years, I think what is fundamentally important is that there is a break with the past and there is a revolution in the social consciousness of the people, whereby they will no longer tolerate the repression of the past. They broke with that barrier of fear, and they're moving forward in a completely different way. Which way exactly that is, I am not sure exactly what is the point of arrival or when they will arrive there.
Yeah, just to stay just for a moment with Syria, and I don't know how well acquainted you are and how deeply with Syrian politics. I guess that, as you say, the big difference between, say, Egypt and Syria is that in Egypt, the military decided to cut Mubarak loose, and in Syria, that military apparently has decided that its survival literally depends on the government's survival. And so far, the Syrian military is hanging with Mr. aside. I suppose the question is, how here in the near term does that continue, or can you imagine some possibility that that there the military would turn on the regime as it did in Egypt?
Just to start with the end, let me tell you and tell your listeners that I am more worried about Syria than I am about any other Arab country.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a chance that a civil war would break. I mean, we already started some signs of it. Escalation towards civil war and maybe the breakup of the country is possible now in Syria, unless there will be an implosion within the army or the regime. And that takes me back to the first part of your question, and that is the different natures of militaries in the Arab world, and that is a specificity of each and every Arab country. I'll tell you, and I'll try to be brief, what is common among the dictatorship in the Arab world is that they were capable, since the last dictator took over in 1991, and that was Bashir in Sudan, before him Ben Ali in Tunisia in 1987, and before that Mubarak in 1980, and Saleh in Yemen in 78, and before that, of course, Gaddafi and the Ba'ath in Syria and the Ba'ath in Iraq and so on and so forth. So you can imagine the last change happened more than two decades ago. And the capacity and the durability of those regimes was because they were able to make the armies or the special forces, some of them called them presidential guards, some of them called special forces, some of them called Republican guards, depending on the country. But the message or the role was one. They had a major part of the army, well-trained, well-financed, that's simply an extension of the regime. And that was sort of a little army that polices the larger army. And that we saw that more in Syria and Libya, and less so in Tunisia and Egypt. And hence, in Tunisia and Egypt, that have more of a state structure, the military was able to break away. But in other places, as in Syria and as in Libya, the special forces, the Republican Guards, are really an extension of the regime. Their well-being is that of the regime, and hence they are making the move forward far more complex than other places.
Huh. In the last couple of minutes here, I'd like to also have you talk a little bit about the future here or the near future, and address the concerns that people, I think, in the West have about the possibility that Islamists would come to power or have more influence in the governments of these countries that they had before. And the concern, I'm sure, that a lot of people, what they think of is Iran. And they go to these common places that you indeed touched on, that people have somehow tried to make this argument that Islam or the culture of this region is somehow incompatible with democracy. And that people there respond and they say, no, I don't think that that's true. At the same time, I think that they would say, but, you know, perhaps they would have a particular kind of approach to government that would be different from ours. So what do you think, what kind of governments would be likely to see? Or, you know, when people talk about democracy, what is it that they mean?
This, of course, I discuss at length in the book, and there's going to be absolutely no way to try to summarize it.
I understand. I apologize for asking such a complicated question at the end.
No, on the contrary. It's actually, I think this is, the bottom line is, especially for your, Chicago, Illinois listeners and others who are really keen and interested in the region, of course, this is the question in many people's mind, and I think it is an important question, even for people in the region. Let me just sort of give you sort of, you know, two or three main observations that I had. And I've just came back from Egypt and Tunisia. And I spoke with the two heads of the two main Islamist parties, Ennahda party in Tunisia. I sat down for 45 minutes with Rashid Al-Ghannouchi, the head of Ennahda in Tunisia. And I sat down with Khairat Al-Shatir, the head of the strong man of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. I walked away with the following impression. Of course, they commit to the democratic rules of the game. They commit to the idea that if they lose elections next time around, that they will step aside. They commit to the idea of democratic state and a civic constitution, pluralistic constitution. And here, of course, I can imagine a lot of your listeners say, but they're lying. They probably are going to go Iran's way. And even they say they are not going Iran's way, but you know, I'm sure they will be doing that slowly but surely. And here I have two caveats. One, that might be true, in a sense that they are building popularity now in order to take control and impose the strictest interpretation of Sharia law. And I think there is enough consciousness in the Arab street today not to allow that. Just as they reverse dictatorship, they would reverse repressive Islamist-like, hold on power. And the second thing, and this is for me is quite telling, is why would Islamist parties who are winning in a major way in the Arab world today continue to schmooze democracy, continue to pretend they are Democrats, continue to defend themselves as Democrats? And I think the quick answer to that, the short answer to that, is that the idea of democracy and freedom has become so important, so central, because of the revolutions in the Arab world, that each and every Islamist party reckons that the idea of democracy is bigger than them. Because usually you don't schmooze something that is weaker than you, you schmooze something that is bigger than you. And I think in the Arab world, there's that common collective consciousness in favor of democracy that I think the Islamist parties will have to abide by. And if they don't, on the short or intermediate and long term, they will be reversed themselves. Because people have elected Islamists to various positions in parliaments in the Arab world because of their sacrifices in the past and because they were juxtapositions against dictators, because of their social networks, because of their capacity to bring people to the polling stations. I think this will no longer necessarily be the case when other political parties come to the fore in the next phase, when civic constitutions are adopted and when people have more leeway and more time to organize and express themselves.
Okay.
So I would say there is something to be worried about, but in the overall, I think the revolutions have opened the way and have created enough of a consciousness whereby I would be less worried today than I have been any time before.
There we've got to leave it. Marwan Bashar is a senior political analyst with Al Jazeera English. His book is The Invisible Arab, published by Nation Books. Mr. Bashar, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, David.